We had a several years in a row financially where we were in the 1.5 to 2 million range with like 50% to 60% net revenue margin. So I was able to invest a lot, which had always been the goal. It was successful, and I did absolutely love it, and I'm so proud of it. But I loved it until I didn't anymore. 2.5 years ago, I made the decision to scale down my business effectively, a soft close on the doors and walk into a completely different way of living.
Today's episode, I'm joined by Megan Telpner, a best-selling author, nutritionist, and founder of the Academy of Culinary Nutrition. For a decade, she built a thriving global business, teaching thousands of people to live and cook with intention. But after reaching what looked like the peak of her success, Megan did something unexpected. She decided to step away. In this conversation, we talk about what it means to walk away from something that once defined you, how to listen for your next chapter, and why rest, creativity, and joy can be just as important as ambition. Oh, Megan, I'm so excited that you are here. Maybe you can give everyone a background about who you are and what you do.
I don't know how to answer that anymore. So maybe that's where we start. For a long time, I was a nutritionist and I ran the Academy of Culinary Nutrition from 2013 to 2023. In that time, published 2 books that became bestsellers, certified more than 3,000 students in 85 countries, and had a baby. He's now 8 years old. And that is who I was. 2.5 years ago, I made the decision to scale down my business effectively, a soft close on the doors and walk into a completely different way of living. So what am I now? And I don't know. I'm a mom, I'm retired, I'm working on saying the following. I'm an artist. So there's a lot happening, but I don't know how to answer that one little question.
Yeah, that's what I found would happen to me too when I left my practice. All of a sudden, I used to be able to walk into conferences and things and be like, oh yeah, I'm Dr. So-and-so. And like it was easy to be able to introduce myself because I fell into a box people could understand. And now I'm like, I don't know, I'm trying some creative things and it's fun and I'm seeing if I can write. I don't know. So I understand what that feels like. Let's take it back a little bit. I know you got into nutrition for very personal reasons. Can you talk a little bit about how that started for you and then how this career unfolded?
Yes, my original passion and love from a child was sewing and designing my own clothes. From when I was like 7 or 8 years old, I took a sewing class with some friends and I just kept going. So my undergraduate degree was in fashion marketing. And that kind of killed my love and passion for the art and creativity of fashion. And I ended up moving into advertising, getting jobs with advertising agencies. Prior, I guess, sort of in between the move into my quote unquote career, I graduated from university having a bit of a crisis. I got sick and that kind of progressed. And so that was how I ended up going into nutrition after 3 years of, seeing all the doctors and all the practitioners. I was diagnosed with Crohn's disease and autoimmune disease. Took a natural approach to healing it, which was just about 19 years ago. Have remained symptom-free. So I went through the path of healing that naturally, and that was ultimately what inspired me to go study holistic nutrition and figure out what I'd been done that I'd been told by every doctor was impossible and healed. And from that, I was inspired to start teaching cooking. Be like, we can transform the trajectory of our lives by making different choices. And if we can start in the kitchen, that feels like an easier way in than let's reassess your whole self-identity.
Yeah, and good for you because 19 years ago, I mean, now I think nutrition is a lot bigger of a topic, but 19 years ago, that information wasn't there. I was in practice 19 years ago, and I mean, I felt like half of my job was just telling people there are options. There are things you can do for yourself to help yourself heal, especially with an autoimmune condition, which is, you know, wreaking havoc on your body. It really does start in the kitchen. So good for you for recognizing that.
You know, I had no background in nutrition or science or basic biology, but to be told that what I eat has no effect by the health of the digestive tract, you know, even my fashion degree, I knew that there was another way through. And fortunately, my mother was always a little bit skeptical. And so I had that support in pursuing a different path. And thank goodness I did.
Yeah, thank goodness. It's so helpful when you can actually get that good food into your body. Also funny, I'm going to have to hit you up for some tips on sewing because I have this like lifelong dream of sewing my own outfit. I don't want to get into fashion, but I've started to learn how to sew in my, you know, my kids are teens now, so I have a little bit more me time. So yeah, I'll have to chat with you.
I mean,
about
I can
that.
Tell you right now what I'd recommend.
Yes.
I mean, there's lots of sewing studios popping up because, you know, we are moving back to craft. It's the antidote of the 2025 life. There's also a great website, Domestika. Like
okay.
Low membership. You can sign up for all kinds of courses, learn like, you know, how to make a tote bag, like start so basic. It's one of those skills. I started sewing quite young. In middle school, I won the Family Studies Award. In high school, I won the clothing award. I was the student designer for the fashion show. Like this skill of sewing to me is like, learn how to file your taxes, learn how to manage a bank account, learn how to mend your own clothes, learn how to cook a basic meal. Like these are the essentials that every human needs to have.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. I'm going to look it up because I'm really interested in it. And my poor mom, she's like, I could teach you lots of things, but sewing is not one of them. She's like, I was terrible. My mom tried to teach me and I could never do it.
No,
so this is something that I'm going back to now at this age.
It's in my DNA. My grandparents, after the Holocaust, immigrated to Canada and my grandmother opened a corset shop. Sewing custom, she sewed brassieres and girdles and all the things of the 50s, but she was one of the first to sew custom bras for women who were having mastectomies back in the 50s and 60s.
Oh, so cool.
So my first sewing machine was hers, and I had like elastic and all these trimmings from her shop. She passed away before I was born. But you know, these are the life skills that AI will never replace.
Yeah, and you're right. It does. It's very tactical. Like craft, there's something to craft that is really special.
Yeah.
I want to go back a little bit to your career because of your, you know, you have these books and you had these many, many students in your courses, and you were teaching for it sounds like 10 years, which is a really long time. You had sort of this what would look like from the outside very, very successful career. You were helping people. You were changing the world. You know, as someone who was sort of reading your posts and following your recipes and things like that, I thought, oh, this is so amazing. She's doing what she loves. So maybe just take us back to that time for a moment before we move to where you are now. How did it feel doing all of this work?
I loved it. And it was more than 10 years. I taught in person in this space that I'm still in for four years before I put any cooking classes on the internet. So it was in-person workshops and classes. Teaching on the very edge of my knowledge. I did not know how to cook when I started running a cooking school. I had 6 recipes to my name that were, you know, sort of recipes, like rice wrap salad rolls, like a ginger soup that was carrots, onion, ginger, and salt. But I started teaching it and then would just, you know, I've always had a thing for creativity and tactile, and cooking is a full sensory experience of you're touching things and you're smelling things and you're seeing it, and all of that has to work together. So even going through nutrition school, the cooking was the fun part. I would look up ingredients and try and figure out ways to make them delicious, because to me that was where the fun was in learning how to do this, was how to make it realistic for life. And so that's what my cooking classes were. I've never been shy to ask for things, and at the time, the National Post, which is a, you know, Canadian national newspaper, was starting their blog and were looking for writers, and they were starting a food component of it. And I just wrote to the editor saying, can I contribute? Can I be a regular writer? And he was like, okay. So I started contributing a weekly recipe, which meant I had to create a weekly recipe. And that was the impetus to actually develop my skills in cooking. And then those recipes would become part of my classes and that part would grow. And because of the National Post was syndicating my own blog at the time, which was called Making Love in the Kitchen, I developed a nationwide audience, which was really cool. And people were saying, can you film your classes? Can you live stream it? And you couldn't live stream from your phone in 2009. So that was when I started thinking about how to make this accessible to more people who can't be in my 600 square foot kitchen in Parkdale, Toronto. And that was really when I started experimenting with more video. I did my first live streamed class. It was September of 2012, I want to say. And it required a whole crew. Like, there was gear. There was like leveling up there was like a whole thing to do this well. And I had six people as like a live audience in the kitchen. And that's when I was like, okay, like, I can do this and I'm on to something. And so my first online class launched in, maybe I'm a year behind, maybe it was 2011. My first online course launched in June of 2012, which was intended to sort of be a precursor to my first book. And that was when I realized the scalability of it, because I could fit, 25 people for a workshop where they were just watching in my place. And that first course, I had 100 people register at $279 a person. And I was like, wait a second here. Like, not only can I do what I love, but I can make a lot of money doing this and like build the life. And I'd always said I was going to retire early. I just didn't know how I was going to retire early. And that was when I started. So I used that money to fund filming a few more courses and a few more courses. And then put out the first version of the online Culinary Nutrition Expert Program in 2013 and had 100 people sign up for the first full run of that program, which I sold, I think it was $2,499. And with that, I was like, okay, we're on to something. I started writing my second book and I was like, what if my books were the textbooks for this program? And I refilmed everything using the recipes from my cookbook and relaunched the program under the brand of the Academy of Culinary Nutrition. And I don't want to say it blew up, because it wasn't like that. I had a singular focus of building this company, building a team, simultaneously creating something that people who joined had tremendous value from, that I loved building and creating, and also working to create a place that people love to work at. That last part took time and a lot of work, because we can't do all things well. I learned how to manage a company, how to be a CEO, which again, not a job title I ever wanted, not a job title I ever loved. And so what ended up happening in the final, COVID hit in 2020 and I had the exact right business at the exact right time. And it wasn't like I was ready to scale, like it already was there. So 2020 was our best year ever because everyone's at home, everyone's wanting to cook suddenly. 2020 was great, 21 was great, 2022 was great, but it was harder to pull the numbers that I now needed to support the big company I'd grown and maintain the margins I wanted for my goal of early retirement. And I hired a really amazing operator at that point, who was basically running the company and gave me this freedom to do more of what I wanted to do, gave me more confidence that what I wanted to do was possible. We were poised to dramatically grow. And then 2023 rolled around and I wasn't loving it as much anymore. I was running a corporation. I'd been incorporated, technically speaking, but I was running a company where I was having only quarterly one-on-one check-ins with individuals from my team. I was not creating a lot of new things because I had the cash cow that was working and was amazing. And we had a launch that wasn't what we'd anticipated, which I kind of suspected. And ultimately, I looked at what my job was. I was like, I don't want this job. Like, if it weren't my company, I probably would have resigned earlier. I didn't like being a CEO. I was in a mastermind group. I was meeting with all these amazing people. I had all these, you know, a notebook full of ideas of how to build and grow this company and generate more revenue. But generating more gross revenue wasn't generating my net that I had specific goals for this retirement, which I'd blown through, by the way. So I didn't need the money anymore. And then I had, at the time, a five-year-old that I was exhausted at the end of the day. My team was across Canada, so I was on Slack from 7 a.m. till 9 p.m., which was, again, my own lack of discipline and boundaries around when I was and wasn't available, because I cared and I wanted to help my team and I wanted everyone to be happy and I wanted to this company to keep succeeding and all those things. So it was successful and I did absolutely love it. And I'm so proud of it. But I loved it until I didn't anymore.
Yeah.
And that was it.
What was, at that time, because I know it's different for you now, what was success to you? Like, what were you aiming for, maybe pre-2020?
It was, I wanted to build a company that first and foremost supported a quality of life goal that I had and that my husband, you know, we a joint quality of life dream, which we were living for sure. I wanted to have positive impact. I never wanted to be anyone's like guru. I didn't want them to keep having to come back for more and more classes and more teachings. I wanted everyone to take this program, become wholly self-sufficient and discerning humans. We offered the opportunity for them to become certified instructors so they could buy a package of courses and go off and teach them. I didn't want a share of what they earned. I wanted them to know that with their own effort, they too could transform and build whatever life they wanted for themselves. And I did all of that. So that was what was successful. And then I wanted to make a lot of money.
Yeah. How, and you don't have to share exact, but as much as you're willing to share, when you were at your peak, let's say, how big would you classify, like for other people to know, like, oh, this was actually a big successful company?
We had a several years in a row financially where we were in the 1.5 to 2 million range with like 50 to 60% net revenue margin. So I was able to invest a lot, which had always been the goal. And it wasn't for lack of paying people in my team. It wasn't for overcharging anyone. So it was really in delivering great service. So, and my goal was always to have 400 students, never got to 400 students in a year. The closest we came, I think, was in 2020, and it was like 389. We were always somewhere between 350 and 389, the student range. We were able to increase the value per person by adding things like our teaching resources portal and, you know, other things that they could invest in to upgrade their skills. So that was, and we had several years that we had that run, and it was mind blowing to me that, you know, from a $65 cooking class in my kitchen, that was what it had grown to. And I was able, because I always had a really clear vision on this, I didn't keep pouring more and more money into it. I wasn't interested in earning that money. You know, I didn't want to earn $1.5 million and it cost me $1.4 million to get there. I never advertised the revenue of my company. It was irrelevant. I always advertised the number of students we had, the reach we had, and the impact we had, and the fundraising. I would advertise the money we raised for Thrive, which was a, you know, my charity partner for about 10 years. Those were the metrics, the outward metrics that, you know, those were my vanity metrics that I felt were impactful and powerful. The money thing was a personal lifestyle goal.
Yeah, it's awesome that you had such a clear vision, because I think a lot of people can get sidetracked into the sort of machine of it, where you start rolling and then you're like, oh, it could be bigger. And then you get influenced by the people that you're around and the suggestions that you get. Did that ever happen to you?
Well, it didn't happen to me, but I watched it, and I watched Shark Tank, and I would watch these shows where people think they need outside investment to grow what they want to grow. Like, what is wrong with building a company that's profitable, that serves your life goals, that you enjoy operating, and that you have the capacity when you, you know, you have to know your numbers. You have to know when enough is enough for the life you want to live. And more isn't, you know, like I don't keep spewing cliches, but more isn't more if it doesn't align with what's in your heart and the life you want to live. I gently tiptoed down the path of acquisition in 2019. I had a 2.5-year-old son. I was absolutely exhausted and was like, I can't do this anymore. And found a really the right kind of buyer for the company I had. It was evaluated at 8 times the gross revenue, which was like, yeah, holy cow. And also, when we started getting into the weeds of it, the lawyers, the accountants, the, you know, all the documentation, all of it, and the buyout and what my next 2 years would look like. And I was like, I can earn this myself if I stick with it a few more years. I don't need that. And I can earn it by not having to report to someone else or fulfill someone else's quotas. And if they're investing that much, it was also terrifying to me because, like, now I have to deliver to somebody else. I put enough pressure on myself. I didn't need more of that. And so I walked away from that and realized, like, you know, why do that if I can, you know, keep going for a few more years? And thank goodness I did.
I want to ask you a question I don't get to ask very many people. And that is, how do you know what is enough for you? And how did you stay sort of grounded in your vision when it's so easy to get caught up in, you know, all the excitement and the buzz?
We had a goal. I had a goal to retire early. So that was the first thing. We had a goal on our first house to pay off our mortgage by a certain time. So that was another thing that we figured out. And then we crunched the numbers. We looked at a full year of, and this was back in, I think, 2018 or 2019, we did this, a full year of what our life cost. And not like we had the essentials, but I wanted, you know, I love traveling and I've become fancy pants. Like, I want to travel nicely. So, like, what does that cost? I don't buy a lot of clothes. Like, there's certain things that just aren't of value to me. But so we figured out, you know, living how we want to live, what does that cost? And then, you know, buffer another 15-20%. And you figure out that number, you multiply it by 10, that's when enough is enough. You invest the 10x amount of your cost of living, earning optimally 4-5% compounding interest a year, and most investments will earn more than that. You can live off the interest without touching your principal, and optimally you live below that and the principal keeps growing and you're good. Like, it's not complicated. And it was just that when money started coming in, I never changed how I can't say I never changed how I lived, because I did in some ways. Like, we stay at nicer Airbnbs. I would hire a private chef when I travel because I'm away for 2 weeks out of the year at that point. Like, I don't want to be in the kitchen planning 3 meals a day. Like, that's not a holiday. In 2021, we moved into a larger home. Josh was, my husband had a clinic downtown. The lease was up. So we made that conscious decision. Why pay rent if we can pay that into a mortgage? So how we live has changed, but it's never impacted. I've never made a purchase or an investment decision that required me to work more. And that's kind of the parameter. We could buy a cottage. If we bought a cottage, like, I've done the math on it, is that worth having to work a whole lot more? And it never was. So, you know, even down to, like, I pay attention to everything. A pair of jeans, if you're, you know, they're, it's $500 for these fancy jeans and you work out your hourly rate is actually maybe $28 or $40 after tax. Is it worth 3 days of your life for that pair of jeans? And to me, that's not even remotely deprivation. It's a liberation, and it's a freedom, knowing that I get to choose a life of freedom over being tied to desires of consumption.
It's interesting because I think one thing I'm hearing from you is really knowing what you want and also knowing the numbers. I think it's really easy for people to get caught up in comparison. You know, this person has a bigger house, this person is going on a nicer vacation. And it is relative. Like even me, we used to start at like very small, you know, sort of hostel type places. And now I'm like, oh, I like a nice bed and I like the nice covers and, you know, more space. And so you travel a bit differently. So I see how it can spiral out of control. But I think the thing that grounds me, very similar to you, is I know what the vision, the kind of life that I want to live, and I know the numbers. And for me, the thing that really hit me was my parents. Like they worked, they were immigrants, they worked three jobs, they set up their whole life so that they could give me a better life. And now I look at them and they say, you know, we don't have the health to travel. We don't have the, like, we saved up all this money and we just didn't live the way that we wanted to live because we were hustling so much. And I feel like it's such a privilege and luxury that I can make those choices that they weren't able to make. And that's sort of what grounds me. It's like, why would I want to work if my health is at risk? Why would I want to work if my family, if I'm not able to, you know, the things that they did for me sort of really resonate for me and keep me on track. And it sounds like you're very similar in that vision.
I am. And I think a big part of that, you know, I imagine for your journey and for mine is knowing your heart, like knowing what really, really matters. So, I mean, when I moved into my new house, everyone's like, well, give us a tour of your new house. I'm like, no, like that's my home. I didn't buy it to put on display. I don't share photos from my holidays. I don't give tours of where I'm staying. I don't post meals. It's not for anyone else. And social media is so weird and you can feel like you know someone. But if you ever went into my feeds, you're like, actually, there's really not a lot in here that reveal. It's like everyone sort of fills in the blanks in their own imagination. And I've learned that no matter what I put out there, people will fill in the blanks with their own imagination for better or for worse. And recognizing that, you know, what you invest in your life, it has to be for you, your family, your, like what's truly in your heart. As soon as you start living for external validation, you will get lost. You'll get lost in the matrix and you'll get lost in that comparison trap and you'll get lost in your own life and a crisis will come that will wake you up. It doesn't need to be painful. Like it doesn't need to get to that. It's just, you know, we have to learn to, you know, shush a little bit, be quiet and listen.
Yeah. It's also never ending, right? When you're looking for external validation, it just never ends. It's like, I just need more and more and more. So I think you make a really good point. I thought actually before talking to you that you were going to say that your definition of success had changed, because I think there's a time in life when you're younger and you're trying to establish yourself. You know, you want to pay off your mortgage, you want to make sure you have enough financial resources to raise your family and all of these things. And then you sort of get older and you think, okay, I also want to have the lifestyle as well. And so there are different stages in life where you're prioritizing maybe different things, but it sounds like your definition of success sort of stayed consistent all throughout.
I think so. I mean, I'm at an interesting place because there was definitely the financial success piece and business success, which felt very important. I had very clear goals and I knew the journey I was on and, you know, checking the boxes on my approach up that mountain. And then I got to the top and I looked around, I'm like, this is awesome. But had I not known where I was headed, I'm not sure I ever would have, you know, stood up there and looked at the view. So what has changed in terms of like my metrics of success is that I no longer have that goal of building a company and building financial freedom. And like I did that. The success that has remained the same, or the metric that has remained the same, is the quality of life, is what do my days feel like. Throughout all of this, there were days that were hard, and there were days I'd wake up with a knot in my stomach or something big had to happen, or there were hard decisions or big problems to solve. But it was always from a place of joy and creativity and intention. Like who I am hasn't changed probably since I realized who I was, which I would say was probably my early 20s. And confidence in who I am has grown for sure. But, you know, now I'm embarking on different projects and I don't know what the definition of success is for those yet. aside from creating with love and joy, keeping it meaningful and joyful, which again, that's always been the same. It's the validation metrics have shifted. So that's something I'm navigating, and it's been extremely confronting.
Yeah, tell me about how it's confronting, because I'm sort of in the same place as you in the sense of like, I had these very, you know, clear metrics in my practice. I want to help this many people. I want to, you know, also wanted to make money, but I really wanted to make a difference. And now I'm writing and it's taking me really forever. And I'm like approaching all of these struggles trying to write this book that's like a really intense big project. And it's a very interesting thing. I'm trying to remind myself that, oh no, actually my goal is for growth. My goal is not, you know, to have this done at a certain time and this certain deadline. It's like, I just want to try. I want to be creative. I want to experiment. I want to grow and learn and hopefully set a nice example for my kids who are now looking at their own career. I have to remind myself of that sometimes, especially when people ask me, oh, when's your book going to be done?
Yeah. I mean, I'm unwiring 45, almost 46 years of a way of operating. I'm in this really beautiful mastermind group with three extremely intelligent and successful by all kinds of metrics people, and we met last week, and I am answering your question about the confronting. We met last week, and we meet, and each we take turns facilitating these sessions, and this one was like a 3-page double-sided, I'll call it a form. I hate forms, with lines and boxes and questions to fill in, you know, like that kind of thing. And I'm given this thing and I'm like, ugh, I hate these things. And one of the people in my group grabs it from me and puts, I don't know if you can see, he put an A+ on it and then gave it back to me. It was still blank. He goes, there's your A+. Now you can just fill it out without the pressure. I was like, damn you. You don't know me. So that's the part that's been confronting, is all of these things in our society that tell us we're doing good, like the, you're doing good, you're a good person, you're productive, you're efficient, you are contributing, you are of value, you are of a service. Undoing all of those things is really, really hard. And I have been an overachiever forever. I had a stomachache before school in grade 2 if there was a test. Cleaning out my studio space, which I've been doing, finding my transcripts and my letters of recommendation and this patterning. I said to my mom, I was like, were you like amazed by how successful I was so early? Because I didn't, you know, I'm just going through it. And she's like, well, all you did was work. All you ever did was work. Whatever it was, you worked as hard as you could. And so now I'm, you know, I said at the top of our interview, like I'm working on using, you know, the phrase, like I'm an artist. And what does that mean? Like, there's no quota. Like if I do 5 pieces of art a week, then I'm an artist. Or if I sell something, then I'm an artist. Or if I get a commission, then I'm an artist. Or if I teach someone else how to be an artist, then I'm an artist. Like, there's no qualifier for this. And that is what is really confronting about this stage, is what makes for a successful day when I don't have a to-do list to check off or a email to write or a sales thing to launch and meet a goal. There's no A+ in for what I'm now doing. And that is really hard.
It's interesting that you were so driven by productivity, or at least the A+, like you're a good person, you're a good student. I'm very driven by helping people. Like I think as a young, you know, from a young age, like I was really into volunteering and all these things. And my career was helping patients. It was like, this is how I'm successful. I had to at that time grapple with like, what if I couldn't help someone? Or what if, you know, it didn't work out or something like that. And now I'm doing all this stuff and I'm like, is it really as helpful as helping someone with their health? And it's like, oh, it's really hard for me to be like, am I creating value? Am I creating a legacy? Am I doing something good in the world? And I'm starting to realize, oh, there is another way to look at things. I can do good in the world in other aspects of my life and still feel like I'm creating something. Like the confronting aspect is really interesting.
What I'm learning through this, I'm really loving this conversation with you, by the
way.
Me too. Because I've been like noodling on it, but it's not something we talk about a lot, really. The thing that I'm learning through this, you know, how am I of value is a question, because, you know, like you and your naturopathic practice and me and my work, I learned so much too that I'm like, how can I not keep sharing and teaching and guiding and serving? And that was also part of my sense of accomplishment, was like, how successful did other people become through what I was able to share? And I never took credit for someone else's success. Like I wasn't looking for like, thank you, Megan, I wouldn't be here without you. It wasn't that at all. It was that I'm so proud, and not even proud, but like, it's not the right word. I'm so grateful you were able to achieve what you achieved. And I'm honored to have been part of that path. Like there was that too. But what I'm learning now in this stage where I can't get my A+, I can't get my 6-figure launch, I can't, like, and I never really cared about those numbers, but it's that we can now be a living permission slip of what's possible, and like loosening the grip on what we were so tied to, that to me is the practice every day.
It's an everyday practice for sure. Is there anything that you have let go of, or something that maybe now is important to you that would have surprised you, maybe your younger self?
I'm surprised. What has surprised me is that I'm not that driven.
Mm.
Like I thought that was hardwired, like ambition and drive was hardwired, and that was it for life. And everyone sort of joked that like when I retired, I would start coaching people on how to retire. Like that would be my next thing. And I kind of knew that I didn't want next thing that was that out there. And I, you know, I built this whole website and I put all these services on, and like then people started hiring me for them. Like, I don't want to do any of this. Like it's the next natural progression to coach and guide. And like, I don't want to do that either. At least not now. Yeah. So the drive that's not there, the ambition that's not there, and I also don't know, like I'm turning 46 in a couple weeks, like how much of that is just, we move from the mother, I mean, we're always the mother, but into this like enchantress stage where we've collected wisdom, but still have, you know, power and energy and enthusiasm to operate differently. You know, I don't know how much of it is biochemical in that I just don't have that need to prove anything anymore.
Yeah, I do think there's definitely a transition. I mean, whether it's age, whether it's hormones, whether it's societal, or kids are older now, and like there's all these changes that happen. I think that happens very significantly for women, more so than men, because it's so tied to our reproductive years and our changes that happen in our body. Also something I could talk about for ages, which is hormones. And I have two daughters and I'm like, oh, you're going through teenage hormones and I'm on the other side doing, you know, it's very explosive in our house, my poor husband. what would you say to someone who maybe is looking for a change? You know, you sort of, I guess, knew where you were headed with this mountain of goals that you had. And I think a lot of people kind of get to a place in life where they're like, this is not right. It doesn't feel right. We need to move. I need to change. I need to do something different. But it's scary. There's a big risk. There's a lot you're gambling on, a lot of uncertainty. Do you have any, I guess, thoughts for someone who maybe needs a change but has no idea how to start?
It's not easy. If it were easy to live in alignment with your soul, our world would be a very different place. And so we have to take on the practices, whatever they may be individually, to connect with that part of ourselves, that inner knowing. I call it the OG AI, like our ancient intelligence that exists within us. And you can do that. I think that's the first step, is for people to reconnect with what brings them joy. Whether that's, you know, creating art for the sake of creating it, not for the finished product. Like the process is the practice. So whether it's, you know, painting or drawing or weaving or cooking or gardening or whatever your creative expression is, do more of that more often would be the first and I think simplest step. You know, I'd say like, well, just sit down and meditate and it'll all just come through. You'll get the download. It's not going to happen. I think you should sit and meditate and whatever that looks like, you know, stare at a painting for 5 minutes, you know, ring some bells and listen for the sound to stop. Like there's all kinds of ways to just, you know, come back into the present moment. That doesn't necessarily mean you have to sit on a cushion, because that's going to be a hard leap for a lot of people to take. So bringing yourself into joy and then finding moments of stillness, and then you might start to listen and hear things come to you, and it comes in forms, unfortunately, you can't predict and you don't expect. So those moments of seeking out the joy, creating the discipline to carve out the time to do the things that bring you joy, like there's a process to this, because you can't just leave it till when you have time, because you haven't made time, you won't. And then kind of looking and listening for the clues. And also recognizing you do not have to quit your job. You don't have to create a tornado in your life to shift how you feel in living your life. Carving out the discipline to have, like, you know, cultivating the discipline to carve out the time might be all you need, actually, to say, you know, I have an hour in a day that lets me tap into the cosmic wisdom of the soul to come through me to create something that's never been created. That can be all you need to start to tap into what brings you into alignment. And then you listen for those clues and you watch for those clues, and they come in, and it's, you know, one choice after another you make with intention that brings you into operating your life in alignment with who you are today.
Yeah, I talk a lot about intentional decision making. People always ask me, like, how do I make these choices? Partly in practice, because a lot of times you're making decisions that are, you know, you're up against a rock and a hard place, and it's like all these decisions are going to be tough. But then in life, it's like I also have real responsibilities. I have family. And so I talk a lot about intention. And one of the major things is really to know in your core, what do you want? And I call this the outside problem, where we think we know what we want and we go outside and everyone gives us our feedback and tells us what to do and, you know, tells us what they think of what we're doing. Oh, you've quit your job. Oh, no, you need to quit your job, or whatever it is. And listening, it's sort of a different way that I say it, the same kind of thing what you're saying, is when you're inside and no one is there and you're just in your own space, in your, whether it's a physical space or an emotional space, when you really listen to what you want without all of the other opinions and all of the other judgments, that's when you know, okay, this is where I need to go. And that, without that vision or without that real clarity, it's going to get lost, because you're going to step outside and the wind is going to blow you any which way.
I think one of the challenges we face as women in our, let's say, 30s to 50s, is that we've actually forgotten who we are. Like, you know, you kind of know it in some ways as a young child, and, you know, we survive teenagedom by conforming to whatever we need to conform to. And I think you kind of, like, you have morsels of it, but they get chipped away at, especially when you get into a role of whether it's mother or caregiver, or, you know, you can lose yourself quite quickly. I had a lot of women do my program who were new empty nesters. Like, it was the first year their youngest was out of the house and they could finally come back and do something for themselves. So it's hard, and you know, we wear these masks, we play these roles, and it can be really, you know, to use the word again, confronting to remove them for yourself, like to actually be like, oh my God, like, where am I? Where did I go? Who have I become? I don't know myself anymore. I don't recognize, you know, people will say they look in the mirror if their bodies change. Like, I don't know how this happened. I don't know who this is. And it can happen psychologically. It can happen from a place of creativity. It can happen from a place of just being really busy every day. And again, that's why it's so important to recognize what is the pressures from outside and what's real, and get super clear on the core values you live your life by.
Yeah, it's so easy to get defined by the roles that we play. And it's nice to I would say actually essential to take the time to really rediscover those little parts of us that are our own. I think about this sometimes a lot. What is something that you currently believe or live by or, you know, are prioritizing that maybe once upon a time never would have been something that was important to you or maybe would have scared you in the past?
I mean, two things come to mind. One is rest.
I agree with that one. I'm laughing because I'm like, oh, yes.
Last year, I started almost daily, like taking a 20-minute rest around 2 in the afternoon. I'm like, is this old age? Like, I need a nap? And it's like, no, it's a vital reset because I don't need it. Like, if I'm out and about, I'm going to be fine. But it allows the second part of my day to come from a different place. It's not on fumes. It's not on adrenaline. It's still coming from, you know, a calm, restful place. So, it took me 25 years of doing yoga to realize, like, all I actually need is to just, you know, stretch a bit and lie down. That's all I need. I don't need the headstands. I don't, like, you know, all of that. And the other is that there is value in doing things just because they're fun.
Yeah.
Just because it brings you joy. You know, I never enjoyed documenting cooking, but I had to, or it made sense to, because it was so intrinsically connected to the work I did. But cooking has always, like, was my first love in my adult life. In a creative realm, I still love cooking. I still take care of my health. All those fundamentals that were at the core of the company I built are still part of my life. I just gratefully don't have to tell anyone about it. Creating art is really what I am struggling with intensely. Like all the advice I just gave was to myself. It's something I still predominantly do after I put my son to bed. I've recently added into my calendar in the daytime. And even then I'm like, am I going to adhere to it? I'm going to work on having the discipline to say, no, this is actually the most important thing that I need to do. Yes, I could fold the laundry, and yes, I could prep dinner, and yes, I can, you know, do all these other things that feel quote unquote more important. But also equally important is living from a place of joy and being the joyful rebellion in the world we live in today and coming out in the world in a state of coherence, in a state of love and peace and joy, being that permission slip that others can too. That is my important work right now, which I would have never believed.
I'm learning it from my kids too. Actually, I learned it from my daughter a few years ago. She wrote her first novel. She likes to write fantasy fiction. She wrote a novel just because she was, you know, having fun. It was during COVID and, you know, they were home. And she wrote this book and we self-published because I'm like, I want her to have the book in her hand and have her see the cover and look at what she did. She wrote this, you know, however many thousands of words. And then I saw it happen to her where she's now just finished her second one, first draft of her second novel, and she wants to get a publisher and she wants to get an agent. And she says things like, I was so not productive today. And, you know, I needed to get more done and I didn't get all the edits done. And I'm like, oh, there's such a push and pull between this productivity piece and the art piece. And so I hear what you're saying and I'm learning it and relearning it and helping her to learn and not forget that she started it because she loves it and it brings her so much joy. And I think this is sort of a daily practice for me too. Thank you so much for being here. Is there anything you would like to end with? Or, I mean, I know you're not growing your business anymore, so I don't know about links and things like that, but
I mean, I do have my podcast, The Courageous Pivot. It's great if everyone can just subscribe on Substack. That just makes our lives easier. That's all I kind of have right now. I send out a periodic email, which you can subscribe to at fun.megantelpner.com, mostly of things I'm enjoying that are inspiring me, that I love, whether it's a great pair of yoga pants or a podcast, just because I like doing it. I like sharing, which I always have. So those are kind of the two right now, everything's possible, so who knows?